The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
The other story about Perry Miller that I've heard told was the one where he told his colleagues at Harvard that he'd had a dream. And this dream was very frightening. It was a classroom like this, a chalkboard, and the hand appeared and started writing on the chalkboard. It's like in the book of Daniel. Commandment number one, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Roman numeral 2, thou shalt not make any graven image, etc., right on down the list. And Miller was trembling more and more as each commandment was inscribed on the board. And then at the end, the hand wrote, answer any 7 out of the 10. So that says something perhaps about Perry Miller's attitude towards biblical Christianity. But to come back to his understanding of covenant theology among the Puritans, it is, in a sense, true that covenant theology served this purpose as the Puritans and others in the Reformed tradition began to formulate covenant theology as part of what's called Protestant scholasticism. Really from 1560 on, Lutheran and Reformed circles, both Protestantism in general, as the counter-reformation of the Catholics, starting with the Council of Trent and so on, began to throw up more and more questions. They had to develop their theology in what would be called a more scholastic direction to provide answers to these questions. It was very almost inevitable that it would be done. We've seen how Pietism, in a way, arose as a reaction, in particularly Lutheran circles, to what they viewed as a rationalistic tendency. And they wanted to emphasize the heart rather than the head. In Reformed circles, covenant theology, in a way, is an attempt to combine the heart and the head in what I think is a proper biblical sense. In other words, not only develop these intellectual answers to the kinds of questions the Catholics were producing, but to see how they affected one's life, the inner spiritual life of the individual person. And in a way, Miller's right in seeing covenant theology as steering between the extremes in Reformed theology of either Arminianism or Antinomianism. Those were the two dangers, because the law continued to play a role in covenant theology. Now, Miller saw this covenant theology as a departure from Calvin and from Calvinism. In one place, I think it's in Volume 2 of the New England Mind, not certain of that now, he speaks of Calvin turning over in his grave if he had known how covenant theology was being developed. And you find a lot of this sort of attitude in much of the scholarly literature, even in somebody like, how'd that name escape me? The pastor of Westminster Chapel in London, successor to Martin Lloyd-Jones. He's actually an American. He's the pastor there. Sign of age. Not coming up with names anymore. Next thing you know, I'll be forgetting dates. It may come to me before the end of the hour. I heard him preach when we were over there in London. Anyway, he actually is one of the contributors in the volume that was produced here by the Westminster faculty in honor of Paul Woolley when he retired. And it's a whole thesis about the difference between Puritan theology and Calvinism of the traditional sort. And this has been overemphasized. You'll have many, many people carrying this to a real extreme. And the more recent scholarship has shown that the seeds of covenant theology are to be found in Calvin himself, as well as in Zwingli and other early reformers, particularly our friend Heinrich Bullinger. One person who's written on this is our own Peter Lilback, whose doctoral dissertation in two volumes is on the covenant in Calvin. But the one that's been published and has been most helpful in turning the tide, at least in some quarters, was George Marsden, a graduate of Westminster who teaches at Notre Dame now after teaching at Duke and prior to that Calvin College. And George Marsden's become widely recognized as one of the outstanding scholars on American religious history, particularly the history of fundamentalism. But he's written on other aspects of American religious history as well. In 1970, it's in the journal Church History for March of 1970, he wrote an article, Perry Miller's Rehabilitation of the Puritans, a Critique. And in that, Marsden scores a number of points showing that Miller's knowledge was really rather superficial on the theological end, with his vast knowledge of the writings of the American Puritans. So Marsden has helped to improve the understanding and to demonstrate the consistency of the Puritan covenant theology with Calvinism. So covenant theology is basically what you have in the Westminster Confession and Catechisms. That's really the theme of it, if you had to settle for some theme that runs throughout. And those were all self-consciously consistent Calvinists who worked on the Westminster standards. But one of the things Marsden focuses on to bring this out is Calvin's sermons, that should be plural, by the way, on your sheet, not sermon singular, but sermons on Deuteronomy. Can't imagine Calvin giving one sermon on the book of Deuteronomy. And in his sermons on Deuteronomy, you have this probably as one of the main influences of Calvin on the theology of the English Puritans, because these sermons got published separately and maybe earlier than some of the other writings, certainly than his last edition of the Institutes. And so the people then who were influenced, some of whom we've talked about earlier, William Perkins would be one of these. And you see his dates again, 1558 to 1602, so corresponding almost exactly with the reign of Elizabeth I. Perkins was the main Puritan theologian at Cambridge University from 1582 to his death, and he came close to having the covenant as the organizing principle of his theology, especially as it applied to piety and casuistry. Casuistry is an important word for understanding this period. It's usually, in our day and age, used in a pejorative sense, a negative sense. Somebody who develops an argument that gets him off the hook, that's usually viewed as casuistry. Sometimes it's connected with the Jesuits who hold to the idea the end justifies the means. The idea is they can always come up with a bit of casuistry, some kind of rational explanation to make it come out the way they want. That's the bad sense of the word. The more neutral sense is simply it's the study of cases of conscience. How do you resolve cases of conscience? The Bible tells me to obey my parents, is a young person's question to you. But my mother says when I answer the phone, tell them I'm not here. What am I supposed to do? God tells me not to lie. You see, that's what casuistry tries to resolve, is these things where two different principles may be conflicting in your experience, and then how do you resolve it? Well, in the early modern period of European history, it's like our own day, a society of rapid change. The New World had been discovered. It was having huge economic consequences. The middle class was expanding with commerce, all kinds of new ethical questions arising. Some of the old ways of doing things were now challenged as a result of the Reformation. How do you resolve these things? And Perkins dealt not only with matters of piety, but casuistry, often using the covenant as the key. Well, how does God operate in this area? How do these relationships work out as we apply them to human arrangements? The fuller development of covenant theology came with one of Perkins' pupils, we've talked about before, William Ames, 1576 to 1633. Ames, you remember, was forced to flee to Holland in the early 1600s as the anti-Puritan movement was afoot in England. He served as a consultant to the Synod of Dort. He was a theological advisor to the president, Bogerman, of the Synod of Dort, the presiding officer. And then his work, The Marrow of Sacred Divinity, became the main textbook of his Puritan friends who came to New England. He himself was planning to come, having been professor at Leiden and Franeker in the Netherlands. He was ready as the Puritan settlement got going over here in the 1630s to come, but then died before he was able to. His widow and family came eventually with his library. So his influence certainly came over here. Both Perkins and Ames, particularly Ames, show the influence of the Huguenot philosopher Petrus Ramus, or the French form of his name, Pierre de la Ramée. You see him mentioned in MacNeil. And in line with what Ramus had said about theology, Ames also saw theology as eminently practical. Theology is the doctrine of living to God. I don't know how you would define theology if we asked you that. How do you define theology? What is it? You could come up with a lot of different answers, I suppose. Literally, of course, means the knowledge or the science of God. That's basically what we're working at with systematic theology. But here's a definition, you see, that includes a personal dimension. Theology is the doctrine of living to God. It's not some merely intellectual effort, exercise. It's something that's really practical and personal. Sharon?
Did you say that it was Ramus or
Ames? Yeah, this is Ames. This is Ames' definition, which is very similar to the one that Ramus had developed. So covenant theology, then, is typical of this period of so-called Protestant scholasticism after 1560 in that it represents consolidation, clarification, and elaboration in answer to the questions inspired by the Council of Trent and Catholic responses to the Protestant Reformation and to questions that had come up as disputes among Protestants themselves. Certainly Lutherans and Reformed had certain issues that had to be argued out. And yet, even though covenant theology is properly seen as part of that context of Protestant scholasticism, yet it also represents a systematic theology that seeks to preserve the personal, historical, and practical qualities of the Reformed faith. It's far from being merely an intellectual systematization of biblical teaching. Personal, historical, and practical qualities. It provided a readily understandable and helpful solution to the paradoxical problem of human responsibility in the face of the sovereign mercy and justice of the Holy God. Now, let's admit it, that's a perennial problem. It's one that's not easy to explain to those who seek to learn from you, your children, if you're a teacher. How do we combine the responsibility of human beings with the sovereign governance of God? They're both there in Scripture. I find the most helpful thing is simply to look at the Bible's stories that describe these things. Joseph and his brethren in the latter part of Genesis. You get Joseph saying to them after he reveals himself to them in Egypt, it was not you that did this, but God, in order to preserve life. So the sovereignty of God is emphasized in that context. And yet, look at those individual people, Judah, Simeon, Reuben, etc. They sure feel the responsibility of it. They do their acts as human agents according to their own desires and so forth every step of the way. And so finally, after Jacob dies, you remember they're concerned, now Joseph is going to get us. And so in the last part of Genesis, they come again, and he says the same thing over again. This is God doing his thing for his purpose, and so on. So they still felt the responsibility even after they understood the whole picture. And again, the Bible presents it that way. You can think of, in David's time, Abigail, whose wife Nabal was the fool, you remember. And Nabal wouldn't allow David and his gang to be provided for by his very prosperous shepherds and so on. So David gets pretty hot under the collar, and he's ready to go wipe them out. And Abigail takes action. She doesn't sit on her hands and say, rely on the sovereignty of God. She hears what's going on and goes out to meet David and his people and says, my husband's a fool. Don't do this thing. God will take care of it. But she had to take action for it to happen, and David blesses her for doing so. And you remember, he has a stroke or something like that. So that the Lord does take care of it, and David doesn't have to take action, but it's a result of Abigail having taken action. Paul in the shipwreck and so on, the whole time with the ship and the storm, you know, God has told him what he's going to do. He's going to rescue everybody from this situation. And yet when the sailors start to take action to set loose a boat and escape, you know, Paul says to them, don't do that. They're always combined. Their human responsibility is never removed. And so you get it also in Acts it's chapter 4 or 5, where that amazing prayer, where they say that the Jews, Herod and Pontius Pilate, have done these things to perform what you had before foreordained to happen. See, it doesn't take Herod or Pilate off the hook. They're still responsible for what they've done, but it's all part of God's plan. So again and again, the scriptures show these things as always both existing. And I think that's the thing we have to remember. And again, the best teaching is to get people right into the Bible itself and then let our minds try to work it out. But covenant theology is consistent with this. It's emphasizing the initiative of God, and God is the one who brings it to its conclusion, but it's not without responsible action on the part of the human beings involved. And it really preserves then the personal, historical, and practical dimensions of Reformed theology. It helped to bring the transcendent God from remoteness into relationship with man. We usually think of Reformed theology as emphasizing the transcendence of God, a starting point, and holiness and sovereignty of God and so forth. And that's a good way to understand it, but it's not at the expense of the immanence of God. Covenant theology emphasizes God taking the initiative to come down. The way Calvin puts it, in I think this is in his sermons on Deuteronomy, it's the most sovereign monarch imaginable, and this is written in an age where people were familiar with the idea of monarchy, with all of its trappings of glory and everything else, the wealth of the day being used to glorify the sovereign. The most sovereign monarch imaginable, greater than Henry VIII or Elizabeth I or Francis I or Charles V, any of these people, taking the initiative to make a pact, an agreement, with the lowliest swineherd of his realm. That's what Calvin uses to describe the covenant. And I think of swineherds. I've not had much experience on a farm, but have any of you seen the picture, the movie made in Australia called My Brilliant Career? It's my wife's favorite, so I've seen it several times. But it's, what's her name, the Australian actress, another name I can't remember. Anyway, she is raised in this family that whose fortune collapses, and they don't have a good way of educating her. She has a great vision of how her gifts will be used and so forth, and plays the piano and wants to be a writer. But at one time, the only way she can be supported is she gets farmed out to some lowly relatives of this family in Australia. And the way the film shows it is just incredible. This family are farming people, very humble people, and she's there to be sort of a governess to these scads of children that they have. And they're always out in the mud. It seems like, I don't know if they raised pigs. I think they did have some pigs. But whenever I think of a swineherd, I think of this situation of being in the midst of all this mud and just awful situation. Well, that's the picture Calvin gives of an Elizabeth I with all of her grandiosity coming down to make a pact with the lowliest swineherd of her realm. To Calvin, that's the picture of what God has done in Christ in the covenant. Well, I think Miller is right to this extent, that the covenant theology was key to understanding the Puritans and the way they developed Reformed theology in the 17th century. Now, the main group of Puritans who came over to form the Massachusetts Bay Colony after 1630 adhered to a non-separating congregational polity such as Ames and his friends had developed in Holland. The pilgrims who had come earlier to Plymouth were separatists. They were ones who had already had been bucking the tide in Elizabeth's day. Remember, they were getting persecuted even in Elizabeth's time, went to the Netherlands even in the late 1500s, never felt comfortable there, and saw their children growing up in a different culture and so forth, and decided the New World is the place for us. And so they came to Plymouth in 1620. But they were separatists. They were congregationalists, but separatists. The mainstream of Puritanism, including the independents like Thomas Goodwin, Philip Nye, and the others who were in the Westminster Assembly, were non-separating congregationalists. In other words, they had developed, under the influence of Ames and a few others in the Netherlands, a sense of church government where the local church would still be the main governing body of the life of that church. There wouldn't be a lot of connectionalism and automatically subject to the next higher court as in Presbyterianism, but this would still be a national church. It would be established by law, by the civil government. And that's really what you had in Cromwell's time, in the days of the Commonwealth, where the independents had become the main group in England. But over here in America then, in Massachusetts Bay, this is what's established by law, is non-separating congregationalism. They saw themselves as a lighthouse on a hill, using New Testament language, to furnish a model to England of a pure church in a godly community. Now, one thing we need to try to disabuse ourselves of, too, is to assume that everybody that came over here to America, at least to Massachusetts and New England, was a believer. Even on the Mayflower, what were they called? Saints and Strangers. The strangers outnumbered the saints. So the ones who already were committed to the kind of congregational polity that when they came over in the Mayflower were in the minority. They were the leaders, but there were more who were not members of the church that came with them. In Massachusetts Bay, probably a larger proportion came as professing Christians, but there would be some who would be nominal at best, and not everybody was clearly a member of the church. But they felt they could set up something here that would show in this period leading up to the Westminster Assembly how things ought to be in both the church and in the society as a whole. And that was their aim. So it was an established church situation. Actually, after our U.S. Constitution was adopted in 1787, and then the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments within the first 10 years or so, you had in the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law regarding establishment of religion, nor to prohibit the free exercise thereof. You need to have both sides of that. I guess that's 1791, isn't it, that the Bill of Rights? The states could still have an established church. The federal constitution didn't rule that out immediately. And one by one, the states disestablished any established church that was there. But the last one to do it is Massachusetts. Congregationalism was still the state church in Massachusetts into the 1830s. I think it's 1834 when it finally was disestablished. So that reminds us that this was an established church that they set up in Massachusetts Bay. Rebellion produced the Westminster Standards in the 1640s. The New England Puritans followed suit with the Cambridge Platform of 1648, which differed only with the Presbyterian polity of the Westminster Standards. In other words, its theology is the same as the Westminster Confession. It's only different in the sense that it's congregational in polity. I mentioned to you before that there were three American Puritans who were actually invited by Parliament to be members of the Westminster Assembly. John Cotton, who was teacher in Boston, First Church in Boston. By the way, they named the city of Boston, Boston, in honor of his arrival in 1633. He had been pastor of the very large church in Boston, Lincolnshire. And prior to that, it was called Tray Mountain. And some other name that Larry Sibley mentioned to me. I can't remember what that is. But when he came, his leadership was so important to them that when he arrived in 1633, they renamed the city Boston, and he became the leading. He was not the pastor. He was the teacher, but became the leading influence in the church there in Boston. Thomas Hooker came to in about the same time, Hooker was on the same boat with Cotton. They came over together in 1633, and he moved out to the Connecticut Valley and became the main leader in Hartford, what would become the Hartford area. And then John Davenport was the third one that was invited back, and he was also in the Connecticut Valley in the New Haven area. And when the invitation came, Cotton very much wanted to come back to England for the Westminster Assembly, but didn't want to go alone, and Hooker didn't want to go at all. He felt the Presbyterians were clearly in control and would be dominant. He felt it would be a waste of time. Davenport was interested in going, but he was the only clergyman in New Haven, and they couldn't afford to have him go. So Cotton didn't go then. But they wrote various documents with which the Westminster Divines interacted. Keys of the Kingdom, The Way of Congregationalism were two of Cotton's works, to which Samuel Rutherford responded with his Due Right of Presbytery and so forth. All of that's in the context of the Westminster Assembly. At any rate, you can see how the American Puritans intended to be a lighthouse on a hill to England and were very much aware of what was going on in England. By the time of the second generation in America, the holy experiment of the New England Way, as they self-consciously called it, was in jeopardy. Only a small number of those who had been baptized as children were presenting themselves for membership in the churches, or owning the covenant, as they would say, for themselves. And partly this may be because the New England Puritans insisted on too much in terms of a conversion experience. We know the sort of questions they asked in some of the congregations. We don't know if there was a uniform pattern. But the idea of the church being made up of visible saints was certainly a conscious practice. So they wanted it to be people with a credible profession of faith. And maybe too many felt, I'm not up to that standard, I can't meet that, who would have been acceptable in most circumstances today. Now, the problem with this was, as the second generation does not come into church membership to such a great extent was what would happen with their children of the third generation. Would they be eligible for baptism? Because if they weren't members of the church, they would not be eligible for citizenship in the society. In other words, to be a voting member of the New England Society, one had to have membership in the church. And if they were not baptized, it would jeopardize that whole arrangement. This problem led to the compromise solution known as, terrible term, the halfway covenant of 1662. And see how soon this came upon them. It's the very same year as ministers being ejected from their pulpits in England. It's just within a generation of the beginnings of this New England society when this problem had surfaced sufficiently that they felt they had to come to some kind of a solution. Now, what did the halfway covenant do? The idea was that people like this, who were not themselves able to own the covenant in the full sense, but had themselves been baptized as infants, they could maintain a halfway connection with the church by promising to live a moral life and to bring their children for baptism. So you can see the kind of compromise that's made here. By the third generation, as that generation grows up, the distinction between full members and halfway members tended to be blurred. So if you got up to preach, you'd have out in your congregation a collection of people, and you might not know, they might not be thinking of who's halfway, who's full-time in terms of membership in the church. Solomon Stoddard was a Puritan preacher out on what was then the frontier. This is Northampton, Massachusetts. That's out in the Connecticut Valley, western part of Massachusetts. He adopted the expedient, realizing that he had a lot of unconverted people in his congregation. He adopted the expedient of using the Lord's Supper as a converting ordinance. In other words, he would urge everybody to be in attendance at the Lord's Supper. No problem with that. But then he would use it as an evangelistic occasion, and that's not necessarily a problem either. Obviously, when you have the elements of the Lord's death there before you, and that's what the sacrament's supposed to do, is to exhibit the gospel. But Stoddard used this as a way of conducting revival meetings, in effect, in the evangelistic sense. And he began inviting people then to welcoming them to the table as a converting ordinance. This became known as the Stoddardian Way. And it produced a series of revivals in the late 17th century in Northampton. just by the way, mention here, going a little beyond the boundary of our period, that Stoddard's grandson was Jonathan Edwards. His father married a daughter of Solomon Stoddard, and Edwards became his successor in this church. Stoddard lived a long life into the 1720s, and Edwards came as a young man out of Yale, having learned his divinity there, and served with his grandfather, and then succeeded him when Solomon Stoddard died, and served in this church till 1750, when he was expelled. By then, the Great Awakening had occurred, and there were all kinds of dynamics that entered into it. Rivalry all along from some of his cousins who had wanted to be successor to Grandfather Stoddard. And then things that resulted from the Great Awakening, some people who earnestly prayed and never had a breakthrough spiritually, and one person committed suicide. Let me just mention to you that we pray. I join in this prayer for revival in our day. One of my former students at Covenant Seminary was pastoring a church in Arizona, in the Phoenix area, and he's now in the military chaplaincy, but he told me his people had prayed for revival, and the Lord brought revival. A real dramatic confession, repentance, and so forth. And he was telling me this a couple of years later. He says, "I'm not sure I'd pray for this again." I said, "Why?" It sounded sort of odd. And he said, "Well, with the wonderful aspects of spiritual conversion and so forth, we got into all kinds of problems as well, splits, everything else. And I think that's the history of revivals. Ask Dr. Davis, who's more the expert on it. But I think the Lord uses revivals at times that are particularly dead. When the church has reached a real low point, he'll bring a rather dramatic revival, but Satan is right in there with it. You can almost bank on it. Any place where the Lord is doing his work, he'll get the evidences of Satan's work as well. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't pray for it. I'm not sure my former student was correct in that. But it's just a reminder, when the Lord brings revival, you better have your forces mobilized, because you need a lot of prayer support. Your elders need to be together. The whole church needs to be ready for what will happen. And you can expect both good things and some very challenging things to happen. That's the spiritual life. We should not be surprised. But it certainly happened in Jonathan Edwards' situation. But to get back to Stoddard himself, you have these revivals then occurring out in the frontier in the 1660s, 70s, 80s, 90s. But by the early 1700s, the ministry of Cotton Mather, descendant on his mother's side from John Cotton, and the Mathers had also been significant ministers in New England, who decries the departure of New England from its original goals, what is usually referred to as the declension, and the sermons of people like Cotton Mather, of in effect this third or fourth generation, are often called Jeremiads because they're like the lamentations of Jeremiah in the scriptures. There's this sense of the high ideals that they had when they came and how things have declined spiritually. Now, a lot of recent scholarship on the American Puritans has attacked this idea of declension, that it really was not so bad as people like Cotton Mather made it out to be. They may be right. It may be that things were never as good as Cotton and Mather imagined they were at the beginning. But at any rate, that's been challenged a lot. But I think you can see that something has changed, certainly, when you consider that one of the main products of Cotton Mather's ministry in Boston was a man like Benjamin Franklin. Franklin grew up in that church in Boston. Cotton Mather was his pastor. And he moved at a fairly early age here to Philadelphia and brought with him tremendous gifts, obviously, both mental and energetic spirit of innovation and so on. Franklin's an admirable character in many ways, but not an Orthodox Christian. Far from it. And I think you could say that, in a way, Franklin may be what was becoming the typical product of the Puritans' ministry by the end of the 17th century. More a moralism, Poor Richard's Almanac type thing, and a rationalism among the enlightened listeners as the Enlightenment's beginning to characterize things. Benjamin Franklin would be a good example of that. However, I don't want to leave you with a totally negative impression of Cotton Mather. Cotton Mather was a man who dedicated himself to pray for revival. Notice the date of his death, 1728. Revival started the next year in New Jersey under Theodore Frelinghuysen. And what was the seeds of the Great Awakening, which emerged in the 1730s. So quite often the Lord seems to do it this way, sort of like Moses not quite getting to the promised land. He'll use people to prepare the way, and then it'll come after they've died. Maybe it's one way of keeping the flesh from glorying that he does that. David? Yeah. Well, Mather himself, by the way, the authority on Mather is Richard Lovelace, who has taught for years at Gordon-Conwell. He's done a book on Mather. I guess it was his dissertation subject. But Mather himself, the very fact he decries the declension from the original ideals shows that he was loyal to the original ideals and purpose. But I think even he would represent the best of the Puritans of this era, of this generation. And yet the fact that a Franklin, I mean, we can't all be judged by our products. We'd all be in bad shape if that were the case, because you can always find some pretty bad ones. And I'm not sure that Franklin would claim to be consistent with the teaching. He probably would not claim to be consistent with the teaching he heard. But I'm afraid that it shows the trend of the whole society, that Franklin, in a way, is more typical product of his time than Mather himself. And Mather may have contributed to it. You get more of a moralistic emphasis in these later Puritans by this time. Now, I want to raise one other question about these American Puritans. As I said in earlier remark, the fatal flaw for the Puritans, I feel, was their failure to separate church and state, and that's certainly true for the New England experiment. Believing rightly in a pure church of visible saints, I would want to maintain that. We want a credible profession of faith by those who come to join our local church body. And by that, the session is they interview people. A credible profession means that they can explain, maybe in very simple terms, the gospel. Usually people will describe their experience. Again, it's starting from the human side of things. And that's all well and good, but then I usually ask them, well, why did Jesus have to die? And that sort of objective question. And they ought to be able to articulate at least the knowledge of the atonement, why the cross is important. And then the other facet of a credible profession of faith is that their life is not inconsistent with that knowledge of the gospel. And in that respect, we ought to have a church of visible saints. It should not just be because somebody was baptized as a child that they're automatically a member in the PCA or OPC or CRC or whatever it might be. So, and to that extent, I think these New England Puritans were right. A church of visible saints maintained by meaningful discipline. But with that, the Puritans carried over from Europe the medieval concept of Christendom, the idea that there is a state, a territory under the rule of Christ that coincides with the church, an established church coextensive with the state. And part of this fit in with their eschatology, a post-millennial optimism, which was contributed to by the sort of utopian environment of the New World. Well, you say there were all kinds of Indians and the wilderness, all that to be overcome. That's true. And yet, as you read some of the Puritans, Jonathan Edwards, and even some of the more secular people like John Adams and Benjamin Franklin, you find that sense of this new world that had been opened up with unlimited possibilities. And so that sort of utopian atmosphere, I think, contributed to this as well. Roger Williams, maverick as he was, saw the need to separate church and state if a church of true believers is to be achieved and maintained. And I think that Williams was on the right track. I don't want to agree with everything that he said. He came over, apparently was a man of great charm. He always seemed to be able to get a position without difficulty. He was teacher in the church in Salem at one point, but he always seemed to be the kind of man who was so controversial that eventually he'd get expelled. And John Winthrop, others befriended him, tried to work with him, but always found he was too difficult. He would never quite submit and cooperate with the existing situation. Question back here. Yeah, it definitely would. And that's in the 1690s, notice right at the end of this time. Cotton Mather is involved in that whole process and later writes kind of apologizing, particularly for their use of the admittance of what was called spectral evidence. In other words, these women could, young girls actually, would claim that they had received word from a ghost of somebody who had died. That so-and-so was a witch. And the judge later in the trial said that was his big mistake ever to allow that sort of evidence to be admitted into the proceedings. But it does, the whole thing shows the shift that had taken place by the 1690s. But I think Roger Williams was one, I think his treatment of the Indians, the Native Americans, was exemplary also. He saw that their territory should not be taken without some kind of compensation. And I think he set a proper example that way. But he certainly did buck the Puritan theology and polity. He embarrassed the independence of the Westminster Assembly because right as that was going on, he came over to London to get his charter for Rhode Island, having been forced out of Massachusetts Bay, and wrote his bloody tenet of persecution, advocating total toleration, which showed that the independents or Congregationalists in Massachusetts Bay were persecuting, you see, which was a great embarrassment to the independents in the Westminster Assembly. He wanted the Presbyterians to look like the only persecutors. But Roger Williams was quite a controversial character, and he came back, he became a Baptist. That's why Rhode Island still is rather strong with Baptist churches, more Catholics now. But eventually he left even the Baptist circles and affiliated with what were known as the Seekers. And those were people who felt, though Christians, they would not feel there could ever be any theology imposed on anybody else. Every individual could think it through for himself. Oliver Cromwell was somewhat like that, and John Milton in his last days too. But what Roger Williams advocated in the realm of church and state is what really would become the eventual American way. And it would characterize much of Western Europe in modern times as well. Well, meanwhile, the Puritans had conveyed to these shores the most earnest biblical form of Reformation theology and piety, which would leave its stamp on all of American colonial culture, not just New England. Even in Virginia, you see, even though it's affiliated with the Church of England, started in 1607, it's formed in a time when Puritanism had great influence on the Anglican Church. The Church was never that strong in Virginia because it was under the Bishop of London. They never had a bishop in this country. Christ Church down in Center City, Philadelphia, is the founding Episcopal Church. For the Episcopal Church after the American Revolution. It was actually founded in 1695, because they just celebrated its 300th anniversary. And I'm supposed to finish reviewing a book by the end of November for Harvey Kahn for the Urban Mission Journal, a history of that church. And a lot of the early chapters are about the difficulty they had being Episcopalians when there was no bishop over here. The closest bishop was in London, who had jurisdiction. So they had many, many problems. But the Puritan influence as a cultural influence was not just New England. It was really pervasive through the early American colonies. So in a way, the stamp of Reformed Covenant theology was left on America far more than it would be in England. Okay, we'll take up any of the reading as well as questions you may have on this material tomorrow, and then we'll have the Cromwell video the following week before Thanksgiving time.